From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Special Olympics founder Eunice Kennedy Shriver passed away this week at the age of 88, ahead in Only a Game remembering the woman who brought sport to millions of intellectually disabled athletes. Also, Brazilian superstar Marta makes a name for herself in American pro soccer, and a conversation with Kurt Edward Kemper, author of College Football and American Culture in the Cold War Era. Also ahead, Boston, long known for its friendly motorists and its wide, safe, and well-marked thoroughfares, throws its streets open to the North American Cycle Courier Championships.
We kept going back and forth and missing certain streets.
So you've discovered that in Boston we don't have any signage.
Yeah, basically. Or the signs are turned so you can't really see them very well. You have to keep on going back and forth, even if you have a map.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. In thoroughbred racing, a jockey will frequently try to position his horse just off the shoulder of the horse that sprints to the front of the pack, and there he or she will wait until the front runner tires, then make a move and take the lead when who's first matters most. Are the Chicago Cubs currently employing just that strategy? I'm joined now by ESPN's Tim Kirkjian, who will let us know. Tim, welcome back to the program.
Great to be here, Bill.
So, the Cubs have put some distance between themselves and the National League Central's third-place team, the Brewers. Chicago still lags behind the Cardinals. Does St. Louis fade?
I don't think so, Bill. I think the Cardinals are going to win the division. The Cardinals made two really big moves close to the trading deadline. They got Mark DeRosa from Cleveland, and they got Matt Holliday from the A's. Holliday has been the perfect guy to hit behind Albert Pujols. DeRosa can play third base. He can play all around the infield and the outfield. And I think those two additions, to go with Chris Carpenter and Adam Wainwright at the top of their rotation, I think they're the team to beat in the National League Central. And I think they are good enough to go to the World Series even with the team that they have. That doesn't mean the other National League teams don't have a chance. I'm saying the Cardinals have a chance to go to the World Series, and I did not believe that at the beginning of the year.
Elsewhere in the National League since we last talked, the defending champion Phillies have considerably strengthened their pitching staff. Pedro Martinez won a game for them the other night. Are they strong enough?
I think they are, Bill. They're another National League team that can go to the World Series. They start with Cliff Lee, who has been absolutely brilliant in the three starts he's made for the Phillies since they got him from Cleveland. And Pedro Martinez pitched pretty well the other night. Now, this is all anyone needs to expect from Pedro Martinez is five innings, keep him in the game, two or three runs, get him out of there. That's about all he's going to do for them for the rest of the way. But that will be so much better than what their fifth starter was giving them this year. Pedro looked not like the Pedro of old, that guy's long gone, but he looked the Pedro of 2 years ago, and that's a guy who can pitch effectively in the major leagues, and one start down, one start, pretty good.
Earlier this season, it looked as if the Yankees might have overspent in their signing of pitcher C.C. Sabathia, but he has helped them a great deal lately as New York has raced by Boston in the AL East. How strong a postseason team would those Yankees be?
I think they're really good, Bill. I picked them at the beginning of the year to win the division. Hey, I might even be right for once. Their starting pitching is very good, and C.C. Sabathia has proven to us over the last 3 years that he's just about as good as any pitcher in the major leagues. Now, did he deserve all that money? Maybe not, but he has been terrific for the Yankees, and he gives them that one guy, the number one starting pitcher that they didn't have anything close to last year, and I think they are ready for the playoffs in that their starting pitching is 100% better than it was last year. They have arguably the best offense in the American League, and they still have the best closer in the game in Mariano Rivera.
Boston has had less luck in signing accomplished pitchers. In fact, this week the Red Sox let John Smoltz go. Don't you hate it when great players have horrible final seasons?
You know, I do, Bill, and believe it or not, John Smoltz is not alone. Steve Carlton went through this. Phil Niekro went through this. Juan Marichal went through this. A lot of great pitchers really don't know when it's time. I think John Smoltz now knows that it's time. I was absolutely convinced that he would come back and be a very good pitcher this year, and I was dead wrong again because he's coming off major shoulder surgery. He's 42 years old. The one good thing about it is he did not not pitch himself out of the Hall of Fame this year, and he's still a Hall of Famer for me.
In the AL West, the Angels have opened up some ground on the field, although Texas is certainly still at least a wild card contender. And in the NL West, the Dodgers would seem to me at least to be a lock. What are the chances the World Series pits Los Angeles against Los Angeles?
It's entirely possible. Even though I just told you the Cardinals and the Phillies have a chance to go to the World Series, so do the Dodgers. Now, the Dodgers have to find a little bit more starting pitching if they're going to get there. But offensively and defensively, they're terrific. They've been the best team in the National League from day one this year, and they have every chance to do that. The Angels got off to a slow start, but boy, have they hit stride at the right time. They are going to score 200 more runs than they did last year. That is a significant upgrade. They've overcome all sorts of problems, tragedies, and everything else, and they're back where they are now and where they belong. Last year, when they got knocked out, they didn't score enough runs in the playoffs. I think they have the offense this year to score plenty of runs in the playoffs.
Tim, which teams or pennant races have we missed that you think we ought to be talking about this week?
The only other race we haven't talked about is the strangest race, and that's the American League Central. Detroit has not played particularly well lately, and I am now fascinated to see how the White Sox are going to play for the last 7 weeks of the season. They're going to get Jake Peavy back. He's pitching in a rehab assignment. Some people thought he'd be out for the year. It looks like he'll be back maybe in September the 1st. If he can give them one really good month and get them in the playoffs, they're a whole different team in the playoffs because they'll have a number one starting pitcher, Jake Peavy, to go with Mark Burley, who's close to a number one going into the playoffs. And if you can have those two things going for you, you have a chance.
Tim, the International Olympic Committee announced this week that neither baseball nor softball would return to the games in 2016. Are you dismayed?
I'm disappointed. I mean, I don't know anything about softball, but I've watched our girls play a few games on TV, and they are really good, and we are as good a team as there is in the world. And for them not to be able to play, I don't understand it. Baseball, I'm disappointed, but I must tell you, Bill, baseball is better when it's played at the highest level, and that's in the major leagues. And I've never sensed that there's this tremendous interest in high school baseball, even in college baseball, or Olympic baseball. Minor league baseball is catching on pretty well and has for years, but I just don't think our country cares that much about anything truly except for major league baseball. So as much as it dismays me, because I love baseball, I don't think the country will be heartbroken about this.
Tim Kirkjian covers baseball for ESPN, and much to the benefit of Only a Game, he talks to me about the game even when he's on vacation. Tim, thank you very much, and enjoy the rest of your break.
Thank you, Bill. Appreciate it.
Last Saturday, the day before the L.A. Soul would finish their regular season on the road against the Boston Breakers, the Soul was practicing at Harvard Stadium. One of the two reporters on hand was Dodo Mendes, who writes for a Brazilian paper and works for Brazilian TV. With an enormous smile, he sang the praises of the player whom he'd come to see, the star of the Soul, the leading scorer in the Women's Pro Soccer League, and FIFA's reigning Female Player of the Year, Marta.
In Brazil, Marta is superstar. She's the best. The semi-superstar is Garrincha, Pelé, Zico. All the Brazilian people have a big respect for Marta.
The fans of women's pro soccer in the U.S. have considerable respect for Marta as well, as do her opponents and her teammates, whom she exhorted throughout Saturday's practice with whoops, hollers, and shots that slammed off the post when they didn't find the back of the net. When the Saturday afternoon practice was over, Karina LeBlanc, the goalkeeper for the Soul, spoke about what the Brazilian striker has contributed to the league's most accomplished team.
I think you can see it once you see her play. She's not only a fantastic soccer player, but she's an entertainer. So she definitely keeps the fans enthused, and you know they feel like they've gotten their money's worth. But she's a fantastic person. I mean, she works hard every day. You know, she wants to get better, and I think that's contagious. And I also think that just her passion is apparent once you see her play in the first second.
It was apparent a month ago that the Soul would finish with the best record in the league, thus ensuring that they would host the championship game on August 22nd in Los Angeles. Thus, Sunday evening's game was statistically significant only for the Breakers, who would make the playoffs if they could grab 3 points by beating Los Angeles. Though most of the people in the crowd of 6,600 were cheering for the home team, quite a number wore the yellow and green of Brazil. They had shown up to see their country's most famous female player.
Yes, I am. I love her. She's the best player in the world, and I'm here for her.
Marta did not disappoint her fans, though the Breakers took the early lead on a goal by their own offensive star, England's Kelly Smith. Early in the second half, Marta trapped a pass perhaps 25 yards in front of the goal, bowled her way past defender Candace Chapman, and chipped the ball into the net. It was not elegant, but it was effective. The only other score in the game came when Marta was fouled in front of the goal, and LA's Shannon Box scored on the subsequent penalty kick. It was a win the Soul, which finished 7 points ahead of the second-place St. Louis Athletica, didn't need. But the significance of Marta to both goals underscored her importance to the team's success all season. Afterward, apparently frustrated by the efforts of a translator to render her Portuguese into English, she described the goal she'd scored.
She said she was very hurt, you know, pain in the arm, like in the legs, but she did the goal and she's happy.
Goalkeeper,
you know?
Take my legs and and after goal, yes. Okay.
The pin is going.
So
away
I'm good. I'm not thinking about. So, yeah.
She said, when this thing is goal, no more pin. You know, it's over.
By finishing first during the regular season, Marta and her teammates earned the right to relax until August 22nd, when the championship game will pit the Soul against either Athletica, the Washington Freedom, or FC Sky Blue. The extent to which the Soul dominated the regular season, losing only 3 times in 20 games, suggests that they'll prevail in the final as well, but Soul coach Abner Rogers is assuming nothing of the kind. Even before Sunday's match, Rogers had scheduled a scrimmage against Real SoCal, a U-16 boys team, to ensure that the Soul wouldn't be rusty for the championship game.
We're going to be playing a boys team on Saturday, and they're going to take it easy and not kick us to death. But that will be a true test, because every one of them will be faster than us. I mean, I think Marta may be the only one that may be able to live with a few of them. It's truly amazing. Sometimes we shake our head in training and have to come to terms that her speed is just electrifying.
Like her coach, Marta is not overconfident about the championship game. She would not agree with a reporter who suggested that her team had made dominating the regular season look simple.
I don't think so. You know, we have a good team, but we see in this league so good team too. We have Washington, we have St. Louis, we have Sky Blue, Boston. And other team, you know. So you have to work so hard to win this league. So I don't think it's easy.
In the run-up to the championship game, FC Sky Blue will face the Washington Freedom this afternoon. The winner of that game will meet St. Louis Athletica on Wednesday for the dubious opportunity to move on to the final in Los Angeles, where they will try to keep up with Marta. It's 19 minutes past the hour. Zhao Peng wanted his bride to set a Guinness World Record, and he was willing to pay about $6,000 over and above the cost of the champagne and the limo for that distinction. Hence, said bride, Lin Rong, was married in a dress with a train that measured 2 kilometers or 1.2 miles long and was adorned with 9,999 silk red roses. It's a waste of money, in my opinion, Zhao's mother said, though I understand that he wants to show his love on the big day. Previously, the record had been held by a Romanian whose wedding dress train measured a pathetic 1.5 kilometers and contained so few roses that nobody even bothered to count them.
I want you children to fall right in, 'cause this year wedding is about to begin.
Now I'm the groom, don't start no stuff. I've been waiting.
I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, the Wing T formation and the Statue of Liberty play as anti-communist strategies. But first, on Tuesday, Eunice Kennedy Shriver died at the age of 88. For years, she had been closely identified with the Special Olympics, which she founded, and with Camp Shriver, summer camps for children, some of them intellectually disabled, some of them not. Joining me now to discuss Eunice Kennedy Shriver's achievement is Gary N. Sipperstein, the director of the Center for Social Development and Education at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. Dr. Sipperstein, welcome to Only a Game.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You worked with Mrs. Shriver over the past 15 years in connection with Camp Shriver. Where are the camps located and what is their mission?
If I can go back one step, about 1963, Mrs. Shriver decided to open up her pool in her backyard and have children, children with intellectual disabilities, come to her backyard because she felt they needed a summer experience. That gave way, Bill, to 5 years later, Special Olympics. Recently, just 5 years ago, she said, why not take what I do in my backyard? And so the mission, her mission, was to replicate what she did in 1963.
In the backyard.
In her backyard, and give kids a summer experience.
What is the routine like at a campus of Camp Shriver, or is there such a thing as a routine there?
Well, we've developed a model that's now used around the country, and matter of fact, hopefully we'll be starting up in Kenya this winter. But our model is to bring children with and without intellectual disabilities and all different types of disabilities together as equal partners in a camp. The camp focuses on sports, and from the very beginning when they get on the bus to when they go home in the afternoon, it's all about having fun and sharing the experience of sports.
There was considerable skepticism back in 1968 about people with intellectual disabilities competing in sports. I gather that that skepticism has, for the most part, dispersed.
Without a doubt, without a doubt. Mrs. Shriver had the vision that sports could be the platform to change how society sees people with disabilities. I mean, back then, children with disabilities were in institutions. Parents kept them separate. They didn't have what I call the normative life experience, going to a birthday party, playing t-ball, signing up for soccer. And she saw sports as a way to bring about societal change.
What have you learned specifically about those benefits of athletic competition for people with intellectual disabilities?
Think about a child playing soccer. What they come away with is a sense of self, a better sense of self, a self-confidence, improved self-esteem, and a sense of being on a team. For kids with intellectual disabilities, they also come away with a better sense of who they are. In our camp, at the end, kids say, I can swim. And what's interesting is kids without disabilities say that because in camp, most kids don't know how to swim.
In December 2008, in a column for Sports Illustrated, Jack McCallum wrote that Ireland revised its anti-discrimination statutes after the Special Olympics World Games were held there back in 2003. China and Russia have recently embraced the Special Olympics, and now about 3 million athletes in 181 countries participate in that movement. Obviously, this is something that spread well beyond a benefit for the athletes and their parents.
Well, I think... And I was in Ireland at that time, and we had studied the attitudes of Irish citizens. And what the World Games is able to do is highlight what I like to call the competence of individuals with disabilities. Just recently, when we were in Japan, and I sat and talked to high school students and adults about what it was like to sit in the stadium and watch, for example, speed skating. They would talk in amazement about, wow, they could do that faster than I can. There's a great image. I just have to give you this image. There was a speed skating competition, and one of the athletes fell. And the athlete who was in front, who was winning, stopped, turned around, and helped pick up that other athlete. And that truly resonated in that community, in that town.
It certainly sounds as if Mrs. Shriver will be personally missed. What lies in store for the Special Olympics going forward?
Well, I think maintaining her spirit, maintaining her energy, and maintaining the sort of atmosphere of let's not say no to a new idea. Let's move forward with new initiatives. There are now Eunice Kennedy Shriver Fulbright Fellows who come to our country to learn about inclusion, to learn about how kids with and without disabilities can learn together, can engage in sports together. We have still a far way to go. We truly do. And we're lucky, not just Mrs. Shriver, but we're lucky that we have sports as the platform, as the vehicle to provide opportunities for children, youth, and adults with disabilities.
Dr. Gary Sipperstein is the director of the Center for Social Development and Education at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He joined me from the studios of WUMB on the UMass campus. Dr. Sipperstein, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
If you pine for plentiful podcasts, please visit onlyagame.org and click on podcasts. When is college football not just college football? When boosters are rewarding players with cash, cars, and no-show jobs, certainly, and when television networks are paying the NCAA millions of dollars to televise the games. And how about when Americans perceive hostility to college football as evidence of communist leanings? That's one of the circumstances Professor Kurt Kemper explores in his new book, College Football and American Culture in the Cold War Era. He joins me now from South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Professor Kemper, welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me on, Bill.
The Rose Bowl assumes particular importance in your book. One of the Rose Bowl officials, Edwin Server, said, and I'm quoting now, "So long as there is a tournament of roses, so long as there is a Rose Bowl game, there will be a free United States." Why did that particular bowl game assume such special significance in the early 60s?
Because it was the preeminent bowl game. It was the oldest bowl game. It was the first bowl game to have nationwide radio. It was the first bowl game to eventually have television. It was also in Southern California, which for a good half a century was an Edenic-like place for people. It was something the West has always been more imagined than real to many. And the Rose Bowl was, in some respects, the frontier of college football in that regard.
You write that in their 1961 attempts to create a game between two worthy opponents, the stewards of the Rose Bowl inadvertently laid bare the anxieties, conflicts, and paradoxes of post-war American society. How did you come to that conclusion?
Painfully. It took me a while, but I eventually came to realize that for all of the ever-present understanding in American life that the Cold War was something that was necessary, I kept finding these nuggets of evidence that suggested we weren't entirely sure of where this was going to lead us. We were constantly inundated with demands for material greatness and famously in Nixon's kitchen debate with Khrushchev, where he essentially said that we were going to win the Cold War because we had better appliances than the Soviets did. But at the same time, underneath that is this fear of softness, that material abundance is going to somehow create weakness. And so football revealed itself to me one day as this sense of a little bit of everything to everyone. It was, of course, obviously rugged, aggressive, manly, all these things that we have ascribed to the game ever since the 1890s. But the game also was uniquely American at a time when we were desperately attempting to assert our differences with the Soviets. This wasn't just a game that no one else played. This is a game that no one else understood, that no one else even could have played if they'd wanted to.
Given the difficulty that the people responsible for choosing opponents, two teams to play each other in the Rose Bowl in 1962, faced, give me a rough idea of how they finally came up with two teams and some of the hurdles they had to get over.
Well, the selection process dragged on almost interminably in the fall of 1961. All of these campuses would have to face these issues that really had nothing to do with football. The argument at Ohio State over the role of the Cold War. At Alabama and LSU, the question was segregation and whether they either A, would play segregated teams, and B, under what circumstances and to what cultural meanings. And then the likely opponent was going to be UCLA, and then the students there, including members of the football team, threatened to boycott the game. UCLA was opposed largely because they did not want to play a segregated team, either Alabama or LSU. And once it became apparent that Alabama and LSU were not going to come, then the boycott effort on UCLA's campus fell apart, and then they happily played Minnesota, although it didn't turn out well for the Bruins. They got thumped. But Minnesota proves a bit of an interesting side story because they had actually voted against the contract year after year. And the reason for that was because the way the contract was worded, it said that the champion of the Big Ten would be required to play in the Rose Bowl. And for many at Minnesota and on other Big Ten campuses, this undermined the concept of faculty control. And so when Minnesota was able to win a concession that changed the wording of the contract from the champion of the conference or other representative, then that gave the faculty at Minnesota the ability to turn down the invitation if they so chose, which they never have.
To what extent did it matter that that 1962 Rose Bowl game was a boring game?
Well, in my book, not at all. In fact, other than the first sentence of the introduction where I basically note that it was a boring game, I don't discuss the game itself at all. In sports history, frequently, the games themselves are almost never what we're really interested in. It's what they reveal about American culture and American society that is so intriguing to us. And so the process in which the teams were selected got us into issues of the role of the Cold War in the academy and segregation in the South and free speech. All of those issues came out well before the game and were really unrelated to the game itself.
You quote an Ivy League coach during the Cold War period as saying, "Football is our best defense against communism." How exactly did that logic work on the East Coast?
Well, irrespective of geography, many Americans during the period came to see the game as representative of an American way of life. Now, we seldom use that term to mean the same thing. We all sort of have different concepts of what an American way of life is. In general, I would say it's notions of capitalism and democracy and religious liberty. And so for people to make claims that football was somehow a defense against communism was to say that it was distinctly American. It was un-Soviet. It's what makes us better than them, quote-unquote.
It's a little bit ironic that an Ivy League coach should have said that. Did it follow naturally that colleges and universities that de-emphasized football as the Ivy League did drew suspicion upon themselves?
Oh, absolutely. The Ivy League became, as I note in the book, I call them the favorite whipping boy of football supporters during the period. Because the Ivy League chose to distance themselves from the big-time trappings of the game, at a time in which many Americans came to identify football as I said, distinctly American, it was a short leap for many then to label the Ivy League as being soft on communism. And of course, this is at a time when those connections are already being made by people like Senator McCarthy, for example, and by the political actions of the day, the Alger Hiss case, the Owen Lattimore case, issues where many were anxious about what was happening at the Ivy League campuses in terms of what were perceived to be faculty sympathies towards communism or left-leaning political sympathies.
I'm speaking with Kurt Kemper, the author of College Football and American Culture in the Cold War Era. You're listening to Only a Game. You write that in the 50s and 60s, college football, and I'm quoting again now, contained enough components of force, violence, and deprivation to reassure Americans. What precisely did they need to be reassured about?
Well, in the short run, that we were better than the Soviets. At a time when there seemed to be abundant evidence that America in the post-World War II years was not a society in ascendance, but one in decline. J. Edgar Hoover made his famous comment that one out of every five children under the age of 18 would be a juvenile delinquent at one point. Billy Graham had his crusades in the 50s where he was concerned about moral decline amongst the youth. All of these things caused many Americans to think perhaps that we weren't up to the task of confronting the Soviets after all.
There's another quote in there about somebody who says, I would rather have my son be on the football team than graduate Phi Beta Kappa.
Yeah, that was Biggie Munn, the head coach at Michigan State. I think when we look at each of these quotes, and when I first came across them, I sort of chuckled and thought, well, those really don't mean anything. But as I ran across them literally by the handfuls, they reveal to me not so much that Biggie Munn maybe necessarily really did want his son to be a, you know, an All-American as opposed to a Phi Beta Kappa, but the presumption that those comments could be made and there would be a universal chuckle of agreement. Mm. It marked a cultural acceptance of football that previously only baseball had enjoyed. You didn't need to explain that football was going to help us win the Cold War because so many people had begun to accept on their own terms and in their own meetings that football was good, that football was uniquely American.
Does the force, violence, and deprivation of college football that you mention serve the same purpose now as it did 40 years ago, or do we not need it to serve that purpose since today our wars are hot rather than cold?
Well, I don't know if we ever needed it. I think in terms of a cultural understanding, we don't ascribe the same meanings to the game for a host of reasons, not the least of which is we have incredibly distanced the population in general from our armed forces and our military commitment. I do think that the game is still something that is reinforcing, that says something positive about American life.
Kurt Kemper is a professor of history at Dakota State University, and he's the author of College Football and American Culture in the Cold War Era, published by University of Illinois Press. He spoke to me from South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Professor Kemper, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks so much for having me on, Bill.
He'll be a man they'll test one day. Have him win the Green Beret.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at avfx.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Men in Speedo bathing suits are no longer welcome at the water park at Alton Towers in Staffordshire. This week, Morwena Ongove, the director of sales and marketing at Alton Towers Resort, said, "We feel this small brief style is not appropriate for a family venue. We are also looking into offering complimentary male waxing, which will preserve the dignity of all our guests." An additional statement from the company regarding proper attire at their Splash Landings Hotel at Alton Towers deemed Speedo suits utterly lacking in terms of taste, though acknowledging that, quote, women may hail the return of the skimpy bathers. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a busman's holiday for bicycle couriers. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
As you predicted, an NFL team was in fact willing to take a chance on Michael Vick, and that team is the Philadelphia Eagles. Vick can earn nearly $10 million over the next 2 years. Are the Eagles a good fit for Mr. Vick?
Well, they're as good a fit as anybody, which is to say that there's probably no good fit, really. They do have a quarterback ahead of him. He's not going to play for a while. The circus may die down a little bit, although I do have to admit that it was big of him to admit that prison was a turning point.
NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell pronounced judgment on Cleveland Browns wide receiver Dante Stallworth this week. Charlie, Mr. Stallworth, who recently served 24 days in prison for hitting and killing a man with his car, will not play in the NFL during the 2009 season. Of the penalty that he tacked on to Stallworth's prison sentence, Mr. Goodell said, "I believe that further consequences are necessary." Do you agree?
Well, I mean, I guess from his standpoint I do, but at the same time, this is Commissioner Goodell again proving that he's the sheriff in town.
Women will be lacing up their boxing gloves for the 2012 London Olympics. Charlie, they will compete in 3 weight classes while men will compete in 10. British Olympics Minister Tessa Jewell called the move a step in the right direction. What do you think?
I don't know. I find it odd that we can't watch women playing softball, but can watch women beating the daylights out of each other. I find that a very, very strange trade.
The IOC also decided this week that 7-a-side rugby and golf will likely be added to the Olympic roster for 2016. Tiger Woods had a marvelous response, I think, to that. He was asked for his opinion. He said, I'd love to play for the rugby team. That'd be great fun.
Yeah, I'm interested to know why it's just 7-a-side and not standard rugby. I mean, I guess they could probably get more entries. It's easier to field a 7-side than a 15. I'm not sure about golf. I mean, they had golf in that awful Olympics they had in St. Louis at the turn of the century, which nobody pays attention to anymore. I'm not exactly sure we need it back now.
Speaking of Mr. Woods, last weekend a tournament official at the WGC Bridgestone Invitational told Tiger and the fellow with whom he was partnered that they were playing too slowly. And in golf, that means, they say, you're on the clock. Tiger responded with a birdie. Patrick Harrington, his partner, got rattled and scored an 8 on that hole. I wonder if that was what the official had in mind.
This was totally television-oriented. There was absolutely no reason for them to speed up. They were the last group. They were vying for the championship. Somebody should have told the official where to put his clock, or failing that, cleaned it for him. This was a huge black eye for the PGA, which is pretending to ignore it this week.
It was a terrific shock that it wasn't Tiger who was rattled by this official's getting involved in their match.
No, but he's got his teeth in this guy's leg, and he's not going to let go. I mean, I'm very impressed by Tiger standing up for his fellow player there.
Jamie Moyer, age 46, was dismayed when he lost his position in the Philadelphia Phillies starting rotation this week. Charlie, he was replaced by some fella named Martinez, whose best pitch clocked in the low 90s. What's going on there?
Well, they're giving Jamie Moyer a rest, and they're putting Pedro Martinez up to see how much he has left in the tank. It's intriguing. They got him 12 runs in his first start, so he couldn't have asked for a better debut.
Jamie Moyer probably would have won if they'd gotten him 12 runs, too.
I think Bill Moyers would have won if they got a 12 run.
At least one major league pitcher is unfazed by concerns that using over-the-counter supplements may cause players to fail drug tests. Bronson Arroyo of the Reds said this week that he still takes, and I'm quoting now, 10 or 12 different things a day and 4 more things on days that he pitches. I wonder if this guy has got a contract with a local GNC to mention various products.
Well, I thought that he had the great answer about whether or not he was on the famous list, which is I may be, I may not be. Who knows? I could be. That having been said, he's going to push the envelope on this a little bit because he got one of the drug warriors to say, well, it doesn't really matter if the thing is on the list of banned substances or not. There's an ethical line here. So in other words, not only are we going to prescribe material, we're going to prescribe stuff de facto that we can't prescribe de jure. So if Bronson can continue to make a mockery out of the drug warriors, that's fine by me.
At a Cubs game the other night in Chicago, a disgruntled and apparently no longer thirsty fan threw his beer at outfielder Shane Victorino. The rest of the story would be too simple to bother with if the fan had just been ejected from the ballpark, but it didn't quite go that way, did it?
No, he became a local legend. He wound up turning himself in. I'm going to make the obvious joke now that it's the first time anybody who's thrown anything in the Cubs outfield this year has actually hit the thing they're throwing it at. That having been said, we have to remember that he did violate the Waste of Beer Act, which applies in both Chicago and Milwaukee. The local ordinance it has nothing to do with the salt. It has to do with wasting beer.
Charlie, I read this week that Kurt Rambis, long a player and then a coach with the Los Angeles Lakers, does not own a winter coat, but I guess he'd better find one somewhere.
Yeah, there he should grow some body hair, maybe. He's gone to taken the job in Minnesota, replacing Kevin McHale, the man who clotheslined him famously in the 1984 NBA Finals. So I guess he waited a long time to get his revenge. I wish him luck. He's going to need it.
Normally, it would be too early to begin talking about college basketball, but an interesting question did arise this week. On opening night in Louisville, Kentucky, do you suppose that Rick Pitino will still be coaching the home team?
I thought so up until I saw the firestorm this week. Of course, he's in a very messy personal affair with with a woman he has now admitted to having consensual sex with and in a closed restaurant, for which we can all thank God, I suppose. I thought he would survive this. I'm less sure than I was before, to be honest with you, because the outcry has been a lot louder than I thought it was going to be.
And finally, Charlie, Azim Khan, future professional racer, has been awarded a motorcycle driver's license by officials in India, and this is big international news. Why is that?
Because it's not for a big wheel, it's for an actual motorcycle, and the kid is 3 years old.
His dad apparently thinks he will be a champ, so taking a leaf from the Earl Woods School of Fatherhood, I guess.
Is it just a little tiny motorcycle, do you think? You know, along the sidewalk? I mean, it's not like one of those big Harley Davidson things, I don't think. Unless they make them with booster seats now.
And seatbelts. Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He's also the author of Idiot America, and he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
To experience Only a Game's magical web world, please visit onlyagame.org. Imagine you're a bike messenger on your daily route, careening between startled deer, courier slang for frightened pedestrians, avoiding copsicles, i.e. police officers, on bicycles, and trying your best not to get doored by civilians emerging sleepily from death monsters, that is, cars. You'd have to finely hone your survival instincts to last a day in that world, right? Then why would some of North America's best bike messengers hold their biggest competition on the streets of the American city notoriously rife with such dangers? Only a Game's Michelle Seaton reports.
On your mark. Get set. Go!
Go, Ed, go! Go, go, go! Go, Ed, go!
Get out!
Go, go!
There is no starting line here today. You just straddle your bike near the guy with the megaphone. And the finish line is kind of over there somewhere. You know, by the parked cars. The best advice is to pedal like hell and then just shred it, dude, before you hit something.
Come on, Blake!
Blake! Blake!
Stop!
Yeah!
It's not formal, this North American Cycle Courier Championship. This is the competition's 11th year and its first ever appearance in Boston. On day one, participants rouse themselves from their couches and ride to a nearly empty parking lot on the waterfront, where they ride sprints, show off their tricks, and take part in a package-throwing competition. Organizers in Boston created a flap in the courier community when they redesigned the work simulation part of this year's competition. No longer would couriers ride on a closed course in a public park to do their mock drop-offs and pickups. This year, they'll ride in the open streets, in traffic, which is the real danger of the job. That's why this year, competitors must prove that they've worked as bike messengers. Mark Alford has come here from Indianapolis with seven other riders. He explains why this makes sense to him.
They'd limit it to past messengers or active messengers. That way, I mean, we're professionals and we know what we're doing. They don't want to, like, some fixie kids, I guess you can say, trying to race through the streets and get hit because they don't have a lot of experience on these bikes because these are hard to ride.
Still, there were a few riders who refused to come to Boston. Refused to take part in a competition staged on open roads. Alford agrees that nothing in Indianapolis prepared him for Boston city streets.
They're a lot narrower, a lot more traffic, which is real dangerous. People here are kind of in cars. At first they're nice, and then we kind of heard the actual persona, I guess you can say, of Boston people. And
what?
Just a lot of curse words. So they'd be like, like, you know. Yeah, yeah.
Jacob Smaller, who is one of the event organizers, defends the new rules of competition.
Well, this is, in our opinion, a much more realistic and true representation of what it is to be a messenger. We're competing in doing things that are actually like being a cycle courier and not like riding around in a public park. That's sort of the norm, and a lot of people were upset that we didn't do it the way that tradition is sort of dictated, but we're not trying to break tradition, we're just trying to give a more honest representation of what we do.
The new style of competition hasn't stopped the masses from coming, says Smaller, and he's right. 350 bikers have come to Boston from as far away as San Francisco and Vancouver. They have come with their fixed-gear bikes, called fixies, and their bike pumps and their spare tires, with their beepers and buckled bags, with their cigarettes and slang, with their multiple piercings and relentless good cheer, and with cases upon cases of Red Bull and Pabst Blue Ribbon. And the first thing they all do when they get to Boston is get lost. Leanne Tongoy, who goes by the nickname Tron, spent hours last night in some netherworld of strangely titled towns.
So where'd you get lost?
Oh, trying to go to an after party. I don't even know. Trying to get to Somerville and Cambridge. We went the opposite wrong direction, so. And we kept going back and forth and missing certain streets.
So you've discovered that in Boston we don't have any signage.
Yeah, basically. Or the signs are turned so you can't really see them very well and you have to keep on going back and forth. Even if you have a map.
He's getting his shoes.
On the day of the work simulation competition, very little has changed. Matt Sauna bends over a crinkled map of Boston, trying to figure out how to get to Jamaica Plain and Brookline. Boston, he says, is nothing like San Francisco. On his face is a look of awe.
This makes absolutely no sense to me. It's the best city I've ever ridden in.
Really?
Yeah, it's sick. Everything turns around. It's awesome. It's fun.
10-4, that rider's awesome.
Hey, go ahead.
Got your drop.
Dropping off, changing manifests.
All right, get the continuum off of them.
The competition is headquartered out of a second-floor apartment in Chinatown. Here, riders pick up a manifest, a list of places in and around Boston where they must deliver. At each destination, someone receives the package, gives them a new package, and signs their manifest. Each delivery has a monetary value of between $9 and $15. At the end of 6 hours, the rider who has earned the most money wins.
Dropping chrome bags, new manifest.
Billy Singford is the boss today, handing out manifests, checking signatures, and scolding the riders who don't follow directions. He says the beauty of this competition is that it measures factors other than speed.
It's not necessarily about how fast you can go. It's about how organized you are and routing yourself and knowing which places to go to drop packages and how you can save time that way. So if you go really fast, you're going to fly by, drop, and you're going to be having to backtrack and do an extra 20 minutes worth of riding. So, manifest.
Billy stands in the doorway of the apartment's bedroom. Behind him, four dispatchers work their cell phones and the routing software that tracks how many packages each rider delivers and how much money he or she has earned.
I keep all my manifests. And you said $14 to Puma?
I can't remember what
I said. I heard 14, so I'm assuming that.
Hour after hour, the riders come and go. They dump packages on a growing pile on the floor. Some of these packages contain bricks. Some are empty. Some have pornographic cartoons drawn on them. The riders pant and sweat while they wait for new assignments. They eat handfuls of butter cookies and trail mix bars and drink water in great gulps. Beer, too. And they're smiling, always smiling.
Did the beer start raining from the sky yet?
About 4 hours into the competition, the software crashes, and the organizers can no longer keep track of the riders and the money they've earned. This doesn't matter much because one rider is so far ahead and has made so much money that no one has a prayer of catching her. So Smaller makes the decision to pull the plug on the championship and declare the winner. Aaron Lipke is in 11th place when he hears the news.
I heard we got our butts kicked by a girl, which is kind of demoralizing, but not to say to the fact that she's a hard, really strong rider, too. But
do you know her?
Yeah.
The abrupt end of the competition and its winner, Christina Peck, are both pronounced awesome by the other couriers in the room.
And I was like, I don't know.
There you go.
That is so awesome.
Thanks, dude.
Yeah.
Peck works as a courier in Chicago and is the first woman to win this competition. She seems a bit stunned by the outcome. Peck is thrilled to have won, of course, but she's more excited to be partying and hanging out with like-minded bikers. In fact, she managed to lose her voice at last night's after party.
It's most fun just to come here and see kids from all over. I moved out here from San Francisco, and to come out and see all my San Francisco friends, my Chicago friends, and everyone else that's moved around. So, I don't know, it's fun, but it's also just about, like, messenger community, like, coming together from all over the place.
Bike messengers don't make much money, and the work is exhausting and sometimes dangerous. People do it, says Peck, because of the freedom and because of community events like this one.
Being on your bike all day, hanging out, lots of good friends, lots of good community events like this happen all the time. This is obviously on a much bigger scale, but, and the money, it's a little hard right now. It's definitely slower, but it's totally passable, and even then, it's just so much fun.
Out on the street, the cyclists have gathered to eat and smoke and wonder about when the next party starts and how to get there. In that sense, Boston is exactly like every other city in the world.
Look at this. Did they give you a brick?
Yeah. My thing broke, too.
For Only a Game, I'm Michelle Seaton in Boston, Massachusetts.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Josh Levenshurs. Thanks to Aaron Heinert at South Dakota Public Broadcasting and to Grady Motes at WUMB in Boston. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Michelle Seaton's Courier Championship photo gallery or my Marta pictures, download our weekly podcasts, learn more about the music you hear on our program, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word is from a competitive bike messenger.
Did the beer start raining from the sky yet?
Whoa, dude, beer from the sky. Not yet. This is Boston, not Milwaukee. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.